Collins. Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Monday, May 7th, 2018. Gina Haspel is the known torturer who is currently the acting director of the Central Intelligence Agency. If she continues, she faces hearings starting this Wednesday. And on Friday, she did the right thing. She told the White House she's prepared to withdraw her nomination. But the Trump administration is doubling down on this deeply flawed candidate. And we don't even know the full particulars, because Gina Haspel's history at the CIA is shrouded in secrecy. They claim she was a covert operative for many years, and they're trying to find ways to surface some of her history, but it's going to be cherry-picked, and much of it will be off the record from the public. There would no doubt be some secret hearings of the nominee for this confirmation process. And I believe that Gina Haspel did the honorable thing on Friday, and Trump should allow her to withdraw and find somebody else who doesn't have a background personally involved in torture operations in Thailand, doesn't have a background of destroying CIA videotapes of some of its torture sessions. And there's certainly much more in her history, because she's been at the CIA for over 25 years, and her baggage includes a lot of the baggage of the agency. You know, missing the Korea nuclear developments, missing the truth about Saddam Hussein and his lack of weapons of mass destruction. You know, the slam dunk intelligence that was served up on demand to the Bush administration. And so, I fully believe that she is the wrong person for this job. The hearings could be brutal. And the pivotal person is California Senator Dianne Feinstein, who, of course, when she chaired the Intelligence Committee, she sponsored the investigation into CIA torture that was suppressed by collusion of Republicans and the Obama White House. And she previously used her prerogative in the Senate to block a promotion for Gina Haspel at the agency. Will she show the courage, if these hearings go forward, to candidly challenge this woman's history? Well, now the White House is playing a new card. They're saying that Democrats are opposing her nomination because of her history as a tough woman. Now, this is the administration that has nominated 80%. 80% of the cabinet-level posts are held by men, and most of those are white men. Only 20% of Trump's appointees have been female. And now, all of a sudden, diversity is some sort of an attribute that they are seeking to embrace. And so Trump, in one of his lovely tweets, he channeled H.W. Bush, who once said that Clarence Thomas was the most qualified candidate for the Supreme Court. I want to be fair. This came from Sarah Sanders, not from Trump. Sanders is saying there is no one more qualified to be the first woman to lead the CIA than 30-plus year CIA veteran Gina Haspel. Any Democrat who claims to support women's empowerment and our national security but opposes her nomination is a total hypocrite. Sure. I mean, Sarah, your credibility is zero anyway, and you represent a man whose credibility is even lower. Trump tweeted, "My highly respected nominee for CIA Director Gina Haspel has come under fire because she was too tough on terrorists." Think of that. In these very dangerous times, we have the most qualified person, a woman, who Democrats want out because she is too tough on terror. Win, Gina. This is really insulting, to suggest that torture is being tough on terror, because we know that torture doesn't work. It is not a reliable way to squeeze intelligence out of people, and while occasionally somebody might confess to something that's accurate, for the most part, they will say what they think their torturer wants to hear. And so it remains to be seen. The White House over the weekend kind of locked arms and said, we're going forward on this. And this is the kind of gambling that Trump does all the time. Just ask Ronnie Jackson, who Trump wanted to plug in as director of the VA. And so, will the Democrats stand up and fight? Will they get Rand Paul to honor his commitment not to support Gina Haspel? And could they even get John McCain to climb out of his sick bed or death bed, I don't know what to call it, in Arizona, and show up in the Senate to cast a vote to block Gina Haspel from becoming CIA director? Well, this is a critical week, and we will see how this plays out over the next few days. Meanwhile, on Spook Patrol, the National Security Agency, under the rules of the USA Freedom Act, is required now to tell us just how many telephone records they reviewed last year. And they set a new record. And it's triple the amount of what they collected in 2016. The NSA vacuumed up more than 534 million records of phone calls and text messages from American telecommunications providers. Now keep in mind, under this new system, some of these may be duplicates. Because if somebody made a call from an AT&T phone to a Verizon phone, it would show up as two reports. That said, the number is triple from the year before. And get this, in 2016, the first full year this reporting was required and the custody of these records shifted from the NSA to the phone companies, yeah, it's an extra click now. The NSA has to ask the phone company for my phone bill to find out who I was talking to. But get this, the government obtained orders to target 42 people in 2016, and from that, collected 151 million call detail records. In 2017, the government obtained orders for only 40 targets. Now, there could have been some hangover from the previous year, so that's not necessarily a finite number. But from 40 targets, they got 534 million records of phone calls. Now, what this 40 targets means is that they had a warrant on 40 people. But because of the two-hop rule, they could include in their circle people who were called by the 40 or 42 who were suspected and, you know, warrants were written by the super-secret FISA court. But all the rest of that comes from their friends or people they talk to. And on the second hop, the universe of people who were talked to by those who were talked to by the first person. I hope I didn't lose you in that convoluted explanation. But it shows you what Bill Binney has been telling us for a long time here. And that is that the metadata, and this assumes that we believe the comforting assertions of the government that they never listened to the calls themselves or transcribed them to capture the content. They only look at who's calling who, when they talked, and how long. But that metadata, when you combine it with other sources of surveillance and data collection, is extremely powerful. So Big Brother's watching more than ever before. Interesting report, and I want you to carefully consider the source here, but you're going to be hearing more about this in coming days. The Hill, which is a Beltway publication that's generally fair, not too sensational, not typically too partisan, they are reporting that on Friday, the House Intelligence Committee released an unredacted section of the Russia report that was written by the Republican majority. I want to underscore this, written by the Republican majority. And what it tells us is that information that had been redacted from the first release of the House Intel report shows that the testimony of former FBI Director Comey and his former number two, McCabe, indicates that when Mike Flynn was interviewed at the White House or some other, you know, he may have been in another office, but FBI agents came to see him shortly after the inauguration in 2017. And they quizzed him about his phone call with Sergei Kislyak, the Russian ambassador. And clearly, they had a wiretap on Kislyak's phone, and they knew what the two had discussed. And they didn't give him any warning that they were coming or what the meeting was about. They asked to see him, he said okay, and they sat down and started asking him questions. Well, according to the Republican House Intelligence Report, the committee received conflicting testimony from Comey, McCabe, and former Deputy Attorney General Sally Yates, who carried the water to the White House saying, hey, Mike Flynn could be compromised by the Russians. And the indication is that the two agents who went to talk to Mike Flynn, and one of them was Peter Stroke, they came away feeling that they couldn't accuse him of lying. They didn't have a clear indication. And in the testimony, again, this is coming from the Republicans at the House Intelligence Committee, quote, although Deputy Director McCabe acknowledged that the two people who interviewed Flynn didn't think he was lying, which was not a great beginning of a false statement case. Now, I don't know where that sentence goes from there. It's a fragment. And the report indicates that Comey testified that the agents discerned no physical indications of deception. They didn't see any change in posture, in tone, in inflection, in eye contact. They saw nothing that indicated to them that he knew he was lying to them. McCabe then confirmed this to the Intelligence Committee, according to the report, but added that they'd found Flynn's statements were inconsistent with what they had understood to be his conversations with Kislyak. And so this seriously undermines the plea deal that Mike Flynn accepted from Bob Mueller. And Flynn took the deal that he had lied to Kislyak. And of course, there's kind of the sidebar story that Flynn had lied to Vice President Mike Pence, and that's the ultimate reason why he was fired. Mueller also charged that Flynn lied when he said he didn't ask the ambassador to Russia to stymie the UN Security Council vote related to Israeli settlements. And as I've noted before, that was the real collusion that the Trump administration engaged in with a foreign power before the inauguration. So once again, I'm skeptical of this data coming from the purely partisan House Intelligence Republicans. But today, this is what Rush Limbaugh was talking about. He wasn't talking about Stormy Daniels and the Distractathon being run by Rudy Giuliani. And you knew I'd get to that eventually, right? Well, Saturday Night Live served up a beautiful opening sequence this past weekend with the whole Giuliani, Stormy Daniels, Trump, all of the characters were in the scene. If you haven't seen it, find it online. It's worth 5 minutes. But Giuliani is just out of control. And it appears that he is doing this in close consultation with his client, Donald Trump. So yesterday, Giuliani, in an interview on ABC's This Week, offered new information saying, well, maybe other women were paid off by Michael Cohen, too. I don't know. He said that Trump might take the fifth, and he also said that Trump might refuse to honor a subpoena from the special counsel. And, of course, if Trump invokes the Fifth Amendment to prevent self-incrimination, he'll have to explain away his own campaign comments from 2016. The mob takes the fifth. He was ridiculing Hillary Clinton's advisor. If you're innocent, why are you taking the Fifth Amendment? And so, during a week when Trump is supposed to be making his critical decision about bailing out of the Iran nuclear deal, with the North Korea talks coming up sometime in the next month or 6 weeks, with all the other shit that's flying around, to see Trump and Giuliani stoke confusion, disinformation, float multiple scenarios, I can only see this as an intentional, look over here, because you don't want to see what we're doing right here before your eyes. And so at a certain point here, I lose interest in the machinations of Rudy Giuliani. and a lot of people who had respect for him, I never did, are kind of rethinking their posture. And Giuliani is, here's a good analysis piece from James Homan at the Washington Post. He says that Giuliani is overconfident about his standing with the president, kind of like Scaramucci. I made that comparison last week. He doesn't like it when people get more media attention than he does, and right now, Giuliani is. Giuliani offered incriminating comments about Trump, such as he fired Comey because Comey would not, among other things, say that Trump wasn't the target of the investigation. He is dumping on the kids, trying to protect Ivanka, while saying that Jared is disposable. And it goes on and on from there. And the New York Times on Saturday had a good piece noting the abrupt about-face of Rudy Giuliani, the former Justice Department prosecutor, hardline, mayor of New York, busting all kinds of people for minor crimes. People are shocked that, quote, Giuliani has so quickly and belligerently turned his back on a world he had worked for nearly 30 years. I'm not shocked. He's an opportunist with zero moral compass. You can't expect anything different from a guy like this. So Trump is out there also tweeting against the Justice Department and the special counsel. He continues in the falsehood that the Mueller team is simply Mueller and 13 angry Democrats. There are a total of 17 lawyers there. Some of them did make political contributions to Democrats, but that doesn't mean that they are partisan or that they can't treat an investigation fairly. Trump's tweet, the 13 angry Dems in charge of the Russian witch hunt are starting to find that there is a court system in place that actually protects people from injustice, and just wait till the courts get to see your unrevealed conflicts of interest. Yeah, right after we see your tax returns, Donnie boy. Another tweet, the Russia witch hunt is rapidly losing credibility. House Intelligence Committee found no collusion, coordination, or anything else with Russia. So now the probe says, okay, what else is there? How about obstruction for a made-up phony crime? There is no O, he said. It's called fighting back. And here's a more important story that surfaced over the weekend. That the Trump team, they deny this, hired an Israeli private intelligence agency called Black Cube. And their mission was to dig up dirt on Barack Obama's top national security advisors, Ben Rhodes and Colin Kahl, who were part of the team with John Kerry and others who negotiated the nuclear agreement between Iran, the United States, and five other countries. Trump continues to believe there's a bilateral agreement and he's just going to bail out later this week. So sources tell us that officials linked to Trump contacted investigators days after Trump visited Tel Aviv last year. Trump promised Netanyahu Iran would never have nuclear weapons and suggested that the Iranians thought they could do what they want since negotiating the deal back in 2015. And they hatched this plan. It's not clear that Netanyahu was directly involved, but to not only attack Rhodes and Kahl, but also to dig up dirt on journalists who support the deal. The New York Times, MSNBC, The Atlantic, Vox, and the liberal paper in Israel, Haaretz. So this is dirty stuff. Trump probably feels justified because of the Russian dossier and the investigations that were conducted into his background. And we can't quite overcome the denials that have been issued, but typically these denials are less credible than the reports that they are denying. So we'll see where it goes, but the latest is that Netanyahu is ratcheting up the hysteria about Iran to put pressure on Trump to try to force this decision. And once again, Israel is dictating its policies for the United States in a manner that I find deeply offensive. And Iran is talking back. Its President Hassan Rouhani said the Trump administration would come to rue any decision to renounce the agreement. If America leaves the nuclear deal, this will entail historic regret for it. And I heard a Zionist radio host here in San Francisco yesterday saying that Iran is threatening to use Hezbollah to launch missile attacks into northern Israel. I haven't found that in any mainstream media reporting so far. Rouhani went on to use a real estate metaphor for Trump, saying, hey, you know, you don't buy a property and then a couple of years later decide to renegotiate the purchase, whether it's the purchase price or the terms. And I think Iran is on very solid ground here. Trump is creating conflict where one does not exist, and he is doing it at the behest of the state of Israel. Netanyahu's got to figure out how to make a big apology to the Prime Minister of Japan, Shinzo Abe. Abe came to Israel for a state visit. It culminated in a festive meal at the official residence of Bibi and Sarah Netanyahu, which is where many of the alleged crimes have taken place. Anyway, at dessert time, the chef sent out a selection of delectable chocolate pralines artistically arranged inside a shiny leather shoe. Now, if you've been to Japan, you know how anal retentive the Japanese are about shoes and footwear. And I was once caught by my host at a ryokan, that's a family-owned inn, because I was out in the hallway wearing the slippers that were designated for my six tatami room. And they're very, very careful about shoes. You don't wear your street shoes inside places. So this is as bad as when that guy in Iraq threw his shoes at Bush. This is a deeply culturally offensive message. And it appears that the Israelis were oblivious to it. Or maybe this was some sort of a not-so-subtle dig at Shinzo Abe. You know, I rarely agree with Trump, but he's made a decision to pull the funding from the White Helmets, the Syria Civil Defense. The United States has been providing about a third of the money, $33 million over the last 5 years. And there are serious issues about the White Helmets, who in some cases have been the source of scurrilous information that was never proven related to the allegations of Syrian use of chemical weapons. And we've looked at the White Helmets carefully here. I do believe that they have at least partly a propaganda mission, and I'm glad to see the United States separating from the White Helmets. Trump is also claiming that he's killed Obamacare by cutting the funding. He told his fans in Michigan at a rally a week ago, essentially, we're getting rid of Obamacare. Some people would say, essentially, we have gotten rid of it. But over at the IRS, they haven't gotten the message because they are still enforcing the employer mandate. They're sending penalty notices to more than 30,000 businesses that they are out of compliance with the Obamacare requirements to provide coverage for their employees. So the Affordable Care Act isn't dead yet. But Trump hopes that by claiming so, that will hasten its demise. I want to give a shout out. We don't usually cover natural disasters, acts of God, and erupting volcanoes. But we have several listeners on the big island of Hawaii. John Zweibel, Russ Archibald, my friend Jeff Kay, I just recorded an interview with him this morning. And Kilauea is erupting, 26 homes already destroyed, and who knows where it will flow next. And that reminds me, every day I take a minute to thank the subscribers like John Zweibel and Russ Archibald, who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. And let's add Jeff Stewart, Teresa Paris, Jeff Lipinski, and Paul Lacombe. They're all supporters of this podcast, and you can join them too. Just visit peterbcollins.com, find the menu tab, pull it down, click on Become a Subscriber. It takes you to the sign-up page where you can become a subscriber in just a couple of minutes. Today I'm releasing an in-depth interview with attorney Charlie Swift. He represented Noor Hassan, the widow of the alleged shooter. at the Orlando nightclub Pulse. And in a powerful interview that first played at Who, What, Why, Charlie Swift expresses his outrage at the gross misconduct by the government, which failed to reveal that the father of Omar Mateen had been on the FBI payroll as an informant for more than 10 years, and that was not disclosed until very late in the trial. Here's an excerpt from my interview with Charlie Swift.
Well, because the government has maintained to the Islamic American Islamic community and to civil libertarians, when we dispute the informant program, whether it's actually valuable, does it actually do anything, is putting people into a mosque to create hate and discontent, is that helping? And the government comes back again and again and says, it is absolutely necessary. This is the only thing that keeps America safe. Okay, let me get this straight. Let me just understand here. The worst mass shooting at the time, the worst terrorist attack since 9/11, and the guy's father was an informant. Who are you protecting again? What attacks are you actually stopping with this program? And it's not like they were estranged. They lived blocks from each other and talked on an almost daily basis. And his father's the one who got him out of it. So, huh?
Now,
Mr.
Swift, please expand on that a moment, because that's what I wanted to ask you about. Did his father, we know that Omar Mateen had at least two contacts with the FBI prior to the events at the Pulse, and that the father, as an informant, may have been able to straighten things out for the younger Mateen.
It's almost, that one I'm not at all, I don't have the same reservations. I think his father did. In fact, the reports are very clear that they had conversations with his father, that the intelligence people who were evaluating Omar already had his father as part of it. And that fits a pattern. The FBI doesn't want to look at things that aren't going, the questions that come up. They love the program, and they're not going to do anything to jeopardize the program. And here they had somebody who was in it, I presume they believed was valuable. So his wishes certainly played a big part on it. Certainly the FBI Omar Mateen motivated to go in and apologize and give an explanation rather than continue to deny these after he talked to his father. His father had talked to the FBI prior to that.
There's a lot more in the interview with Charlie Swift available for my subscribers today at peterbcollins.com. Tune in, iTunes, Stitcher, Spreaker, and I'm sure a bunch of other places I can't think of offhand. Well, things are heating up. Tomorrow is primary day in West Virginia, Ohio, and Indiana. And in West Virginia, the coal criminal, Don Blankenship, is running for the Senate. He's got two other Republican opponents. And he's attacked Mitch McConnell in recent days in TV spots that call him the swamp captain, call him Cocaine Mitch because his father-in-law owns a shipping company that's been accused of smuggling drugs. A far-fetched claim, according to the New York Times, but I think it actually has some evidence behind it. And John Oliver, on his HBO show last night, had some priceless footage of Don Blankenship's TV commercials, where he barely moves his lips, much less anything else in his face. He appears to be a wax figure. But he is appealing to people who are more Trumper than Trump. In West Virginia, a state that went heavily for Trump in 2016, is now the subject of presidential tweets. He's pleading with voters there not to support Don Blankenship to pick one of his Republican opponents because, well, Trump blundered so badly in Alabama, where he first reluctantly endorsed Luther Strange and then Roy Moore, and they all lost to a conservadem, a barely Democratic guy named Doug Jones. Trump also went to Pittsburgh to support the guy we've all forgotten about who was running against Conor Lamb, and the Republican lost. And so Trump has to be very careful because he thinks that he can tell his base what to do. But I happen to think that some of the things that attract people in this perverse way to Trump also prevent them from just following his line when they see somebody who's as much of an asshole as Trump running and Trump's telling them not to vote for him. Here in California, the Republicans held a state convention over the weekend. They deadlocked on endorsing either of their front-running candidates for governor here. But in the Senate race, they have a thorny issue because Patrick Little, described as a neo-Nazi, and he proclaims himself as the only America First candidate. No more of Feinstein's Jewish supremacist wars for Israel. So it's fair to call him anti-Semitic and just kind of hateful in general. So he showed up at the Sheraton San Diego, and they kicked him out. There is no room for that kind of speech here, said Cynthia Bryant, executive director of the California Republican Party. Now to the Democrats. An interesting new study surfaced late last week. It's called the Data for Progress Report from the Progressive PAC Justice Democrats. And I've linked to it in the show file for the podcast. I encourage you to read it. What they did was compare the attitudes of voters in a given state with the Democratic senators who represent them. For example, the share of white Democrats who believe that racial inequality is caused by, quote, a lack of willpower among black people, has declined dramatically, and more white Democrats accept that racial inequality is due to discrimination. So, in 2008, 48% of white Dems said lack of willpower is the cause of racial inequality. 37% said it was discrimination. The numbers have flipped. Now only 34% are racists who say that willpower is the issue, and 48% cite discrimination. Now, on the banks, we know that many Democrats, including those who are running in West Virginia, Manchin, Indiana, that's Joe Donnelly tomorrow, they cross party lines to support this bill to water down bank enforcement through the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Well, the report shows the Democratic base supports more aggressive regulation on banks. 92% of Democratic primary voters support more government regulation. 80% say the government should reduce inequality. 86% say the government should guarantee health care. But not our senators. 76% of Democratic senators represent states where support for a $15 minimum wage is greater than 55%, but only 61% of those senators support the $15 minimum. 67% of Democrats in the Senate represent states where support for Medicare for All is greater than 55%, but only 33% of Senate Democrats support Medicare for All. You get the idea. Read about it in the link to Vice News at peterbcollins.com. And finally today, I've also linked to a powerful piece of commentary by a woman named Jane Kim, a progressive running for mayor of San Francisco. And I've told you in the past how, despite the liberal image of San Francisco, there is an establishment group here that constantly prevents progressives from running the town. So, I encourage you to read this piece, because Jane Kim was contacted by a reporter from the only big newspaper here, the San Francisco Chronicle, with a list of really biased and bizarre questions. They relate to her background. She grew up with immigrant parents who did well, and they scraped money to send her to an elite prep school. The reporter tried to shame her for not being honest about how she went to an elite prep school. She also went to Berkeley and Stanford. And she doesn't hide these things in her resume, but the tone of this attempted interview was a gotcha case. They also discovered that her father works for a global cosmetics company with hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue, but it turns out that he went to work for them after Jane Kim left for college. And so they call her disingenuous. They basically say that she is hiding her wealthy background. And it's a real smear job. And I don't even consider Jane Kim my first choice for mayor of San Francisco. I think she's qualified and competent. I wouldn't be opposed to her. But Mark Leno has more experience than any of the other candidates running. And this effort to smear her with questions that were based on opposition research that came from another campaign and phony information. She's accused, Jane Kim is accused, of being the agent of service for a company called Ivy Enterprises. But you know what? They got the wrong Jane Kim. And this Jane Kim, in a 3-minute Google search, found the other Jane Kim. But the intrepid reporters at the San Francisco Chronicle hadn't done their homework. It exposes deep bias and the way progressives are alienated from power here in San Francisco. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. You're invited to share it with absolutely everyone. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.